Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Since the end of the Cold War, a primary aim of American foreign policy has been the extension of democracy, free trade, and democratic and human rights around the world. The proponents of this philosophy, though, have been roundly critical of the last several years of the Trump administration for its seeming backtracking from this policy and its relations with the European Union, Russia, China, and its embrace of countries and leaders with illiberal tendencies, countries like Turkey, Poland, the Philippines, and Hungary. My guest today, though, is a noted contrarian of that 25-year thrust of foreign policy, stating that the policy he calls liberal hegemony has had a dismal track record. Instead, Stephen Walt advocates for a policy of foreign policy realism. He's a professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's previously taught at Princeton and the University of Chicago, and he's a contributing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine and the author of several books, including his most recent, which was published last year, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of American Primacy. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon. Stephen Walt, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
In your book, you write that the American foreign policy has been on the wrong track for the past 25 years, really since the end of the Cold War. And in the course of that, we've squandered a lot of good relations with both of our allies, as well as some of our global competitors. Say we've been pursuing a policy you call liberal hegemony. What do you mean by liberal hegemony first?
It's liberal not in the sense of left-wing, but rather because it seeks to use American power to promote the sort of classic liberal values, democracy, markets, rule of law, human rights, all things that Americans generally support. It's hegemony because it's one where it sees the United States as the indispensable power that has to lead that process and, in effect, use all of the capabilities we have to try and transform the world in America's image, to turn non-democracies into democracies, to defend human rights in lots of different places, to open up the world to foreign trade and globalization, etc. And we want to do this peacefully if possible, but if necessary, we've been willing to use military force. And however great those ideals might be, this policy has been a near total failure.
So certainly in the early 90s, we were supporting democracies in Latin America, in Eastern Europe after the fall. Now, were you talking about those efforts, or are you talking more about after the first Gulf War, we're keeping military presence in the Persian Gulf, which inflames highly illiberal forces within the Middle East that has reacted against that, to trying to bring democracy to places like Afghanistan and in Iraq in the last 15 years?
Yeah, many of those efforts are all part of that. And I think the easiest way to see this is just compare where we were in 1993 or so, early period after the Cold War, and look at where we are today. So 1993, democracy is in fact spreading around the world. Markets are opening up. The United States has a pretty good relationship with China and a pretty good relationship with Russia. In fact, the European Union is expanding. The Oslo Accords come along, so we think we're on the brink of peace in the Middle East at long last. The American economy is doing well, and the American military seems absolutely unstoppable. Right? So, you know, life is good, the wind is at our back, and everybody's very optimistic. Now, fast forward to 2019. Our relationship with Russia is terrible. It seized Crimea, interfered in our elections. Our relations with China are deteriorating rapidly and have been for quite some time, not just under President Trump. There's been no peace in the Middle East. Two-state solution further away than ever. The United States got attacked on September 11th, and as a result of that, then fights two wars, one in Afghanistan, one in Iraq, and neither one of them goes well. Both of them, in my view, sort of costly failures. Meanwhile, democracy is now in retreat around the world. For 13 consecutive years, the level of global freedom has declined. And finally, globalization, which was supposed to make us all rich and sort of raise all boats around the world, hasn't delivered as promised. Good for some people, good for some parts of the world, but not particularly good for the American lower class, American middle class. So you add all that together, and I think you have to look at, say, you know, this hasn't been very successful. And when Donald Trump ran for president in 2016 and said that American foreign policy was a complete and total disaster, a lot of Americans nodded their heads, and that was sort of the picture they had. And I think it was not entirely due to policies we'd followed. But it was, our fingerprints were on a lot of those developments.
So when you talk about our relationship with Russia, was it a matter of pushing NATO eastward to literally its borders?
Well, that was a big part of it. We had assured the Russians when Germany reunified that NATO expansion would not go further than Germany. And that was verbal assurances given by the first Bush administration as part of getting Russia to go along with the reunification of Germany and the inclusion of a reunified Germany in NATO. We then proceeded in the 1990s under Clinton to ignore that earlier set of promises and to start moving NATO eastward. And I think the Russians would have accepted, you know, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic. And if we'd stopped there, it would have been okay. But we continued to add then the Baltic states and then declare that we wanted to bring in Georgia and we wanted to bring in Ukraine. Now, we didn't do either of those because the Europeans objected, but that was the American intention. And at that point, the Russians really began to push back very hard, I think ultimately leading to the seizure of Crimea. I don't defend what Russia did at all, but I understand what Russia did because any great power would be as sensitive to a powerful alliance moving closer and closer and closer. And I think the hope and genuine belief back in the 1990s was that this process was going to create a vast zone of peace in Europe. It was sort of like an oil spot that would be just keep spreading. And everywhere NATO and the EU went would then become peaceful, which is one reason why Americans were willing to do it. We never thought there would be any challenges. You know, if we brought these countries into NATO, we wouldn't actually ever have to defend them because there wouldn't be any trouble. And I think what we're now realizing is, first of all, that did, in fact, create real tensions with Russia and in Russia's backyard where they really can still have some influence, but that also the roots of democracy were not as deep in some of these countries as they might have been here in the United States as they might have been elsewhere. And we're therefore starting to see these illiberal developments in places like Hungary and Poland, which are still democratic, but not quite the kind of democratic system you and I are accustomed to living in.
Well, what would have been a better policy at the end of the Cold War than the one we did pursue of this idea of let's bring democracy everywhere, from Russia to its former satellite states, to Latin America, to the Middle East, everywhere?
Yeah. We should have been much more humble about it. I mean, we should have tried to extend our values largely by setting a good example for others, by not accelerating the process. We should have remembered that the process of building a successful democracy took several hundred years in Western Europe. It took a couple of hundred years here in the United States. There was a little civil war at one point, and that therefore trying to force the pace was not likely to work very well. It was also going to poison our relationship with lots of non-democracies who would naturally see this program as threatening to their elites as well. And finally, of course, it turns out, as we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Somalia and Yemen and a number of other places, that even when regimes do fall, creating a successful democracy in their wake is something we actually don't know how to do. We don't understand the cultures well enough. We don't know how to pick leaders. We don't know how to write their laws. And the people who have lost power aren't usually very happy about it and are going to do things to try and get back in power, some of those things involving violence. So we end up with a costly occupation, a civil war, a failed state, and not a thriving democracy.
And if we're picking the leaders, we're not really exercising American values of democracy in which you pick your own leaders.
That's right. Right. So again, it was, as the title of my book suggests, you know, the hell of good intentions. I think that many of these things were done with the sense that we were going to make the world better. It was going to be good for us. It was going to be good for these societies. And unfortunately, that didn't reflect a very realistic assessment of what was possible.
Well, you've talked about a lot of things that have gone wrong. Is there anything that has gone right in the last 25 years when we come to look at our foreign policy?
There are a number of places where, you know, I think the United States, with some exceptions, has actually managed the relationship with China as well as could be expected. China, once it started growing as rapidly as it did, was going to be a problem. And The Clinton administration, Bush administration, and Obama administration, I think, recognized that and began to respond. They kept getting distracted by other problems, most notably in the Middle East, but they understood that reasonably well. I personally think the Obama administration's handling of Iran and the nuclear deal that was signed with Iran was a success and should not have been reversed. And you know, we'll see if the going the other direction actually leads us into a better position. The Bush administration's program for AIDS relief in Africa, I think, was a notable success as well. And some aspects of our counterterrorism effort against al-Qaeda, I think, was successful early on, not the way it sort of eventually expanded. So I don't want to convey that, you know, we never do anything right. There are no successes at all. And there were a number of crises that got managed. The Kargil crisis between India and Pakistan in 1999 was basically mediated by Bill Clinton. And again, that was done rather successfully as well. But the broad outlines of our policy, I think, were largely unsuccessful, and we missed some opportunities. We missed the opportunity to finally bring the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to a close. I think we had the capacity to do that, but we didn't. I think there are some other places where, you know, we might have been able to stabilize things had we had a slightly more modest approach. And let's not leave out one other thing, right? The financial crisis of 2008 began here in the United States. It had obvious repercussions for the American economy, but it also damaged a number of other economies, most notably the European Union, which has spent more than a decade trying to recover from that and still not fully out of the woods.
You mentioned the China policy. Are you one that sees China's future trajectory as becoming the dominant country down the road?
No, I don't think that's preordained by any means. China has enormous potential, obviously, just simply given its size and the dynamism they've exhibited over the last 20 or 30 years. But China also faces some really substantial problems. It's not in a great geographic location. A number of relatively powerful and not hostile but suspicious or wary countries on its borders, very different than the American situation where we really don't have any significant enemies anywhere nearby. They have a large population, but it's also going to be a very large elderly population because of the one-child policy that they instituted many years ago, which has left them with, you know, 400 million or so people who are in or rapidly approaching retirement age and without the same number of younger people to help support them and deal with them. So they're going to have really significant demographic problems. Their rapid development has produced all sorts of environmental problems, which have health effects and also, I think, is going to undercut economic productivity there. You know, they're, I think, going to be our major rival for the next 20, 30, 40 years. But I think the idea that China is destined to take over the world or be the world's most powerful country I'm not willing to draw that conclusion just yet.
Yeah. You mentioned, though, that how we have dealt with China over the last 20 years, for the most part, has been pretty successful given their rise. Have we undone a lot of that in the last couple of years?
There's sort of good news and bad news, I guess, or different forms of errors. I think we managed the relationship reasonably well. We were, I think, overly sanguine in the 90s about China becoming like us. There, the belief was, you know, we'll bring them into the World Trade Organization, we'll engage with China, they'll develop a middle class, that middle class will want political power, and they'll become a democracy like us, and then everything's going to be fine.
Capitalism begets democracy.
That's right. And I think we're learning, well, that may be true, but only in the long term, that Chinese, let's call it authoritarian capitalism, has been a pretty successful model. And some of what the Trump administration is trying to do now, knocking heads economically with China, is, I think, correctly motivated in the sense that China hasn't lived up to all of its agreements and trying to pressure them to do that. My concern is that we're doing it in a way that's not very effective, and in particular, we're doing it in ways that are undermining our relations in Asia. In particular, it was a mistake to leave the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this multi-party economic agreement that the Obama administration had negotiated that was not only, I think, economically beneficial for the United States and for others, but it was a way of tying a lot of Asian countries more closely to the United States, as opposed to letting them gradually gravitate economically and then politically towards China. Secondly, the Trump administration has picked trade fights, not just with China, but also with South Korea and Japan and some other countries.
Canada and Mexico.
So instead of presenting a united front to confront China about its trade policy, we're picking fights with just about everybody. And finally, I think the handling of North Korea and South Korea has been sufficiently erratic to make Asian countries wary of what American reliability is. It's not that negotiating with North Korea is a mistake. It's not even that talking to Kim Jong-un is necessarily a mistake. But our policy has oscillated from sort of threatening fire and fury to declaring that the two leaders have fallen in love, right? And if you're in Australia or India or Japan, this just doesn't look like you have grown-ups in charge. And what they want to do is be able to count on the United States to be reasonably reliable, reasonably credible, and so they can make adjustments in their policy with a clear idea of what we're likely to do. So I worry a little bit about how we're going to be dealing with China and how we're going to retain the set of partners that we need in order to be an important presence in Asia.
I'd like to ask you about this idea that negotiating with North Korea, meeting with the leader of North Korea is not necessarily a mistake in and of itself. I think there are a lot of foreign policy specialists would say it is a bad idea. Why do you think it's not a bad idea?
Because there is no alternative. North Korea is a pretty heavily armed country who has artillery and missiles that threaten South Korea pretty directly, don't threaten us yet. But it's also a nuclear power. It has nuclear weapons, and it has the capacity to deliver them on some of their neighbors. So there isn't a good military option for dealing with North Korea. And anyone who's looked carefully at what a war on the Korean Peninsula would look like even today, I think, recognizes that you were talking about something that would kill tens of thousands, if not more, even if nuclear weapons weren't involved. And if once nuclear weapons got involved, then we're talking about something truly horrific. And so every American president has looked at that one. Clinton did, Bush did, Obama did, and Trump did, and quickly concluded that fire and fury was simply not the way to go. And that means they're all dragged back to negotiating with North Korea to try and stabilize the relationship, maybe cap their program, maybe get some limits on it, try to gradually improve things. Now, there's a relatively new leader in North Korea, in Kim Jong-un. He appears to be open to some possibilities of a new relationship. He's not a nice leader. He's murdered a number of his family members and other members of the elite. But the point is that Trump wasn't mistaken to try a negotiating process. I think he was mistaken in his belief that he could do it all with his own charm, that could all be done sort of at a personal level, and that you didn't need a lot of prior preparation to figure out exactly what we could realistically ask of them and what sorts of pressures might be able to push us towards a reasonable deal. But I don't think there's any alternative to diplomacy, however distasteful that might be.
My guest today is Stephen Wald, a professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of American Primacy. And he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's move from one side of the world to the other side of the world, where right now we're seeing a big change in policy, allegedly, because I think there's some degree of who knows what our policy towards Iran is. Now, we have withdrawn from the Iran arms deal, the nuclear agreement. Iran has stayed by the provisions of that for the last year, but they're feeling the sanctions now, and now they're threatening to withdraw from that deal as well. Now we're seeing a carrier group headed towards the Persian Gulf. We're seemingly rattling some sabers at this point. What do you think the Iranian policy is of the United States? Because it seems very unclear.
Well, I wrote a short article a week or so ago saying I had been trying to figure out what our Iranian policy was, and I couldn't do it. I have some speculation, but I can think of a number of different possibilities. I mean, it has been a contentious relationship for 30 or 40 years now, since the fall of the Shah and the hostage crisis. And there have been some initiatives made to try and improve it at various points, but nothing really substantial until the 2015 Joint and Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the nuclear deal, which was only intended to deal with Iran's nuclear weapons program and essentially prevent them from being able to go down that road undetected and quickly. And it was, I believe, completely successful in doing that. It stopped Iran from being able to develop a nuclear weapon quickly. Sort of a year at least, we would be able to detect it because the country is now being more extensively inspected than any other country in history. And to this day, Iran has lived up to that agreement, even though the United States has now withdrawn from it. The hope was that that would be a first step, and that then we could then start dealing with Iran on the other issues that we disagree on. We could start trying to open things up. And I think there was a belief that if, you know, we did start economic relations, if more Iranian students were going to school in Europe and in the United States, whatever, the relationship would actually improve. We might still have some areas we would have to knock heads on, but gradually we would not be treating them as a pariah. They would be brought out of the penalty box, if you will, and back sort of to normal relations with the rest of the world. And I think that's what some Iranians wanted as well. What's happening now is we've gone back to a sort of a much more confrontational posture, what the Trump administration calls maximum pressure, where not only have we reimposed economic sanctions on Iran, but we are threatening other countries that if they deal with Iran at all, we will sanction them. And this is quite potent given the size of the American economy. So Iran is seeing none of the economic benefits they thought they were going to get by agreeing to reduce their nuclear program as well. And just last week, they said that if the Europeans in particular do not provide some of the economic relief that they were promised, they are going to make some very modest departures from the agreement. They're not going to leave the agreement entirely. They're going to change a couple of small things that are, by the way, easily reversible. I think this is clearly just bargaining on the Iranian part. But the question is what we're trying to accomplish. I can't tell if it's regime change, which National Security Advisor John Bolton has called for repeatedly. I don't know if we're trying to goad Iran into doing something so that we then have an excuse to go to war and hope to get some support. I don't know if we're trying to pressure them into running up the white flag and saying we'll negotiate a new nuclear deal that's even more restrictive. I don't think that's going to work. Or it's possible we just are trying to keep Iran as weak as possible for as long as possible, you know, sort of put them back in the penalty box. Don't let them develop because we don't like other things they're doing. The administration has not said which of these goals. Maybe it's some combination of them. I continue to believe that there's no great enthusiasm inside the White House and inside President Trump's brain for an actual war. It's the one thing I think he may recognize could really put his reelection chances in jeopardy, particularly if it doesn't go well.
And certainly on the campaign trail the first time around, he was about getting out of Afghanistan, getting out of Iraq, and, you know, staying clear of Syria, he's not been able really to do to the extent that he was talking about.
Well, he certainly was said, you know, no more nation building. Of course, he's continued to keep us in Afghanistan and elsewhere. But he was deeply critical of the wars that had been fought in the Middle East. Said the Iraq war was stupid, even though, in fact, he had said nice things about it earlier before. But he was very critical of that. And he appears to be unenthusiastic. The question, of course, is what happens if we exert, you know, again, maximum pressure on Iran and Iran doesn't budge. If they suffer a lot of pain as a result, but they ultimately don't change their position on a variety of issues. And then his advisors come back to him and say, you know, Mr. President, this didn't work. You're looking weak. We have two or three things we think Iran is doing that worries us a little bit. You're going to have to do more. And then there is, again, a heightened possibility of some kind of military action, particularly if somebody can persuade him that it could be done quickly, cheaply, at no risk to Americans.
And I think we also forget that this is not just between Iran and the United States. It's also between Iran and Israel and Iran and Saudi Arabia.
And that is a big part of the problem here, is that we have a number of allies in the Middle East who are very worried about Iran. So they're constantly whispering in the American ear, you know, please fix this problem for us. And those groups have supporters here in the United States. So there's lots of lobbying groups in the United States who've been pushing very hard on this issue for a long time. What troubles me about this is I don't think any of our current allies in the Middle East are without their problems, right? That none of them are deserving kind of unconditional American support, not Egypt, not Saudi Arabia, not Israel, etc. I also don't think Iran's behavior is so heinous and so dangerous to Americans that it deserves to be treated as a complete pariah. We should be talking to Iran as much as we talk to the others, because among other things, that's what gives America leverage. When Mike Pompeo goes to Riyadh, I want the Saudis to know his next stop is Tehran. But when he gets to Tehran, I want the Iranians to know his next stop is Tel Aviv. Because when he's in Tel Aviv, that his next stop is Ankara to talk to the Turks. Because that way, each of these groups has an incentive to tell Pompeo something he wants to hear to try and win American support instead of taking American support for granted, which is what most of our Middle East allies now do.
You've talked about seeing our foreign policy evolve into a new realist sort of. Is that a new realist view?
I think that would be a much more realistic view, that where the United States has its main interest in that part of the world is maintaining a balance of power so that no country can dominate the region and manipulate the flow of oil, which the world economy still depends on. That's our main strategic interest there, and that doesn't require the United States to sort of park itself in the region and try to run it. It just means we have to help maintain a balance of power. The good news there is there's no country now in a position to dominate the region. It's as divided as it has ever been. So that task is relatively easy for the United States.
You've talked a lot about a view of how to interact with other countries, and especially countries in crisis and in serious situations, of offshore balancing. What does that phrase mean?
One way to think about it is the way that, you know, England, also an island nation, tended to deal with Europe throughout its history as a great power, that it had no permanent friends, no permanent enemies. It would shift its position depending on what the balance of power was in Europe and who looked.
And their own self-interest.
And their own self-interest, obviously, because they wanted to maintain a balance of power in Europe. And what offshore balancing says is, look, the United States is extraordinarily secure here in the Western Hemisphere, economically rich, militarily powerful, lots of nuclear weapons, no enemies nearby, two big oceans, et cetera, and those things still matter. And therefore, the only thing we really have to worry about, really seriously have to worry about, is the possibility of some other country emerging that is as powerful as we are and that dominates its region the same way we dominate the Western Hemisphere. Because a country like that could use its power all over the world the way we do. It could even start interfering in the Western Hemisphere, which is something we haven't faced for over a century. Right? So America's grand strategy should be to oppose any country that looks like it's powerful and about to dominate its region. That's why we entered World War I to stop Germany. That's why we entered World War II to stop Germany and Japan from dominating their respective regions. That's why we waged the Cold War to keep the Soviet Union from conquering Europe, controlling all of that. Today, the only country that might conceivably become a regional hegemon, dominate its region as we dominate the Western Hemisphere, is China. So I would focus most of our strategic attention on Asia and maintaining those alliances, maintaining a strong presence there. I would stay out of the Middle East because there's no need for us to be there. And I would be gradually actually reducing the American military commitment to Europe, because Europe is in fact wealthy enough to take care of itself, particularly if it's given time to prepare for that, if it doesn't happen precipitously. And that's what an offshore balancer would call for. It would stay out of the nation building business, and it would try to spread democracy and other liberal values primarily by force of example, by having a robust, successful, and admirable democracy here at home, which I might add we don't seem to be doing a particularly good job of these days either.
Stephen Walt, thank you very much for your time.
It was a pleasure.
Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and the author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of American Primacy. It was published last fall by Macmillan. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.